Welcome, everyone, to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. Joining me here in the ExchangeWire studio today is our head of content, Lindsay Rowntree. Hello, Lindsay.
Hello.
Nice to be on that side of the table,
isn't it? It's delightful to be on this side of the table. Yeah, it's very bizarre.
You're actually allowed to sort of speak and share a voice instead of trying to get Kieran to...
We'll see what happens with that.
Yeah. And also delighted to introduce our special guest today, Ellie Edwards Scott from the Advisory Collective. Hello, Ellie.
Hello. Lovely to be here. Thank you.
Very glad to have you. Okay, so kicking off as our regular listeners who are growing by the thousands in week by week, as our regular listeners know, kicking off with news items of the week. The first news item I wanted to start with to have a chat with you guys about is Tim Cook from Apple coming out in the press last week. I think it was late last week, after making a speech to the European Parliament in Brussels about the use of data and personal data, and in particular, he was making a point about the responsibility that big tech companies have got in their handling and use of personal data. But I think he was also making some pointed arguments about two big tech companies in particular that he didn't name.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's all guess which ones they might be. He didn't name them, but about the way in which they hold on to that data. And he used very strong language, kind of intimating that big tech companies are in such a powerful position that they can effectively hold on to personal data almost as a way to weaponize against an individual sort of user. And that's in itself is a very interesting way to kind of describe the use of data in a technology context. But what I found particularly interesting was that up against a CNBC article earlier this week about Apple's App Store ad revenue and how it's tipped to grow significantly over the next 2 years. And that to me, because it's contextual targeted advertising, suggests that, you know, Apple's also in the advertising business just as much as anybody else that hoards and uses enormous amounts of personal data is. So my question to you both is what your opinion is of how Apple's advertising business is going to be managed. And are we actually going to see the start of them kind of getting a taste of the power of some of their user data? And will we see perhaps a little bit of a contradiction between Tim Cook's stance of how big tech companies should manage and control people's data and how they actually run their advertising business?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've watched the kind of video off Tim Cook's speech last week, and you're right, he did use some quite strong language in terms of, you know, how data can be used and how the user should be protected, and words like, you know, harmless preferences turning into hardened convictions, and basically saying that the US in particular should kind of go down that privacy route, and mentioned GDPR and cited it's been great in terms of what's happened in Europe, and yeah, you know, they should call for tighter legislation in the US. And looking at what Apple are doing, of course they're going to move into the service business. They're moving from product to service. They have to diversify because their, you know, sales of the phone, the iPhone, I wouldn't say it's stalling, but it's not as significant as it used to be. And if you look at the who's buying them, a younger generation, you know, they're looking at Android more than the Apple phone. So, and also the price point as well is a barrier to that.
So they've got to remain competitive, but, right? They have to find some way to diversify and grow their business.
Definitely. And they've, you know, they are one of the biggest walled gardens out there anyway, aren't they, Apple, in terms of what they do with their store, in terms of having time for developers to develop an app and get that approved to get onto the App Store. So I think they're sitting on an absolute goldmine, and they're recognising that. You know, they've moved into Apple Search Ads this year, but even with that, there is still plenty of real estate that they can monetize around that, because, you know, take the first page, once you get past the first page of the App Store, there is still a lot of opportunity for advertising around that. So I think they're definitely kind of moving into that area. And they hold so much personal data and also have that affinity that a lot of people have, that trust Apple. So,
well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because another word that he used was surveillance. You know, he was trying to say gathering that much data, holding that much data on an individual is a form of surveillance. Mm. And I just thought that's a really interesting way to present that relationship between customer data and, you know, whomever and for whatever reason you might give your customer data over to someone. Mm. And you can't say that Apple's not in that position, in those shoes, in the same way that any other big tech company is.
Yeah, I mean, I think the situation with Apple is always an interesting one. advertisers are notoriously frustrated with Apple. They're very, very difficult to work with when it comes to any form of advertising. And obviously they've launched their ITP, Intelligent Tracking Prevention, on their Safari browser, making it even more difficult for advertisers to get an understanding of how their users are using that particular browser, and think of the prevalence of not just MacBooks, but also iPhones in the world, how that's become more challenging for everyone using the native browser app, which is Safari. On top of that, it's interesting that kind of within the App Store, they're using search ads, because arguably the data that an advertiser can use to target within paid search is much, much different than they can to use in display.
Yeah.
So from that perspective, it does kind of ring true to what they're saying about the way that they don't like how data is being used. And I, you know, talking about some of the terminology he was using, referring to it as the other big companies are using data with military precision. Yes. There's a lot of kind of military references.
Yeah.
So clearly, I don't think there necessarily is a blocker between them. I think everything he said, he's still
holding true
to. Yeah, he still stands true with. But and everything within the paid search arena is very, very different. It's still all, at the moment, very, very keyword-based. And the opportunity within that, within keyword-based targeting within the App Store, is absolutely huge. And there are many companies out there that focus purely on App Store optimization. And this will become a big, big part of what they're able to offer their clients. But, I mean, you have to think about the revenue generated from that. I think the report mentioned $500 million this year, up to $2 billion
yeah,
just in Apple in app search ads by 2020.
Yeah.
Outside of that, we have to remember how much revenue Apple are taking from app developers already.
Yeah.
They take 30% of all in-app revenue from any developer. So if I'm King and I'm posting Candy Crush Saga in the App Store, if a user then decides to buy some coins to be able to add a level, Apple instantly gets 30% of that. So the amount of revenue they're generating outside of this search environment is absolutely ginormous. So to be able to add up to $2 billion on top of that is just absolutely incredible. And I think there's a lot to be said for the opportunity there, without having to go down the
personalized,
super terrifying,
yeah, I was going to say,
personalization aspect
of
it.
They don't need to, because, as you say, they hold so much data anyway, and they have, you know, in terms of the control that they have on the market, on their market, it doesn't need to be about the user per se. It's about the targeting opportunities for, you know, the app developers for and the advertising around that.
Yeah.
Without it being too intrusive on the actual person.
Yeah. I guess it will be interesting to see, because I suppose, you know, just chatting about it in the office this week, I was having a conversation with Kieran about it, and he was just saying, the thing is, once you get a taste of the potential of using some of that customer data, it could really change a company's position. But I guess that depends, firstly, not only on your moral position, you know, I'm quite sure that there was, you know, that there was a lot of, you know, truth and personal intent behind what he was saying to the European Parliament. But I guess, secondly, it depends on how all the other elements of your business pan out, right?
And I'm sure many people have morals when they start this business.
I was going to say,
and that quickly changes.
When you see the revenue start coming in,
when the money starts rolling in,
exactly.
Dollar signs go into the eyeballs, and that's
totally.
The end of that.
Yeah. Exactly.
And it's also, you know, a lot of points that he raised is about making sure the user is informed. So, if you know, audiences, you know, that's what GDPR is about. It's knowing how your data is being used. People know what how they are being targeted and how your data is being used, and you're in agreement with that, then, you know, not necessarily anything wrong with that.
Yeah, for
but
sure.
I also feel like this conversation is going to a bit of an echo chamber, because how much do the users actually know about how data is being used and why it's being used? And, you know, Facebook have got into a lot of trouble this year, but doesn't mean that millions of people aren't still using Facebook.
Well, exactly.
To the same extent that they were before.
Yeah, because I think the other question there is, how much do they care? And I think users care, but only to a certain extent. And a part of that has got to do with how much do they know.
Yeah.
And the other part has got to do with probably, you know, understanding, or maybe not even understanding, but just kind of ignorantly thinking, well, there's a value exchange here.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to ask any questions about what you do with my data. I'm just going
to
use your services and everything will be fine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And as you know, definitely, Lindsay, when we've had these sorts of conversations in other regions via our ATS events, for example, in Asia, it's completely different. They have a completely different cultural approach to this. It's very much, I understand if I give my data over, you're going to give me something back for it. So I'm fine with
it. Yeah. The value exchange is understood.
Yeah.
And we're nowhere near there. Yeah, in the Western world.
No.
Well, we've been ignorant. We've been ignorant in thinking it's free. You know, nothing in life is free. So ultimately, we're accessing these services, you know, and we're getting enjoyment from that. There is got to be an exchange. Yeah. There's got to be something for it, you know.
Yeah. Totally. Okay, moving on to the next story, which is actually sort of a slightly helpful segue, to be honest, which is a story that BuzzFeed released this week about some fairly extensive and sophisticated ad fraud scheme that they've uncovered, which is involving more than 125 Android apps and websites connected to a network of front and shell companies in Cyprus, Malta, BVI and other European locations. And the article goes into quite a lot of detail about that scheme and how it works and, you know, and how and why it favours an Android app environment over an iPhone app environment. But it also talks about how ad networks and ad exchanges are used in this scheme, including some major players. And it goes on to say that, you know, some of those major players, such as Google, there's absolutely no evidence that they knew any of this was going on. But it begs the question, from our perspective in the mad tech world, is this just yet another example of how ad fraud is just carrying on completely untackled in our industry? How on earth do we get on top of something like this? And because of the extent of its sort of you know, proliferation. And then the sort of follow-on question from that is it not just continuing to shunt marketers and agencies into spending their ad dollars somewhere where they feel much more secure and comfortable about what's happening to them?
I mean, it's rife, isn't it? I was reading the article and it goes into such depth. I mean, firstly, it's like, well, I could set this up myself because it goes into such depth about how to guide. It's a great how-to guide. I mean, it's just like, right, okay, I need to buy it, you know, offer money to an app developer, set up a shell company. It literally goes through step by step. But actually, it's quite terrifying when you look at the extent of it. I mean, Pixelate, they came out with a report and it was interesting because kind of midsummer this came out, but it didn't seem to make such a big impact.
I think Pixelate launched it on their blog post
in June. So this isn't new, and it's again, you know, we know it, fraud is rife in our industry and we know it's an issue, and how do we tackle it? And is it only when some of the big players are involved or named that it actually people start sitting up and looking about it? Because Pixelate went into quite a lot of detail at the time and named a couple of companies that they'd identified as, you know, the shell company that even reached out to them. I think it started with investigating that called Megacast and kind of built out from there, and they saying it was about $75 million dollars worth at the time, and actually it's about tenfold that amount. But, you know, what can be done about it? So Ads.txt, should it be implemented? You know, that's something that IAB Tech Labs talked about again earlier this year, implemented within mobile. That's a step towards it. Google, interestingly, pushed back on about it at the time. And actually, we're finding that
they haven't now.
No, I was going to say, and the articles explicitly mentioned that.
They've been really kind of
trying to work on initiatives like that.
Well, they need to, though, don't they? Because as you say, it's primarily within Android.
Yeah.
And they found rogue players on the network.
Yeah.
God, how do we tackle it? Oh.
Yeah. I think this is the thing. I mean, if you're a layman looking into how this works, and the fact that someone came in and created a shell company, bought some apps that already had a decent user base, and then looked at how those users were using the app, then decided to create bots to actually mimic how those users were using it, and then merge them together so it all looks like it's coming from humans. If you're a layman looking in, you're going, well, there's no hope at all. If I'm an advertiser, I'm thinking, well, there's no chance. And actually, you know, Rachel, your question about kind of, will it just kind of send marketer dollars back out of the app space again? Probably, because one of the biggest reasons that advertisers aren't going near an app is because of the fraud concerns. Mm. And how do they mitigate that? And, you know, big stories like this coming out and being posted by the likes of BuzzFeed
is not going to help
that in the slightest. Because actually, if you look at some of the trusted players and you do like create direct relationships and use some of the most trusted exchanges, then the level of fraud is very, very low. But there are players like this out there that are trying to game the system. And if I'm an advertiser and I hear that potentially 90% of the money I put into that was actually being served to bots, not humans, I'm not going to want to touch it again. Mm. And it takes another bout of re-education for them to understand, actually, this is how you need to deal with the in-app space effectively and efficiently and safely. Mm. That's how it's going to go. Otherwise, it'll go straight back to mobile web again. Because first of all, it's easy to do. It's just like desktop. And second of all, you know what you're getting
for
your money.
Yeah.
But it's also, you know, the vendors have to take control. As you say, Google are now, you know, and working to combat this. But once an app is on the store, what are Google and Apple then doing to kind of revisit that, to check that it's, you know, it then becomes about the users and, you know, user rating, customer reviews, etc. But there has to be that much more dialogue with the app developers, the app creators, and just kind of making sure that it is what it, you know, what it was set out to be.
Yeah.
And that actually, is it, was it sold 6 months on? Who, you know, six months after it has kind of appeared on the store, who is then in control of that? You know, the vendors have to take some responsibility as well, because we've got to get trust back into it.
Yeah.
You know, in-app advertising does work. It is effective. It's a huge opportunity for the right type of advertisers. And we have to bring back that security for advertisers, because what are they going to do? I mean, fraud is prevalent online, and we as an industry need to all work together to solve this.
Yeah. And ultimately, the fraudsters, all they care about is the money. Mm. And that's all their focus on is making money from fraud. Mm. Whereas the rest of us have day jobs to do outside of that. So they will always be one step ahead. There's no way you can ever kind of catch up to them or overtake them. But there needs to be more done as a collective to ensure we are trying to tackle it as much as possible.
What are the networks doing? Every single step of a chain has a responsibility, don't they?
I mean, you saying earlier that there's no evidence that Google were aware of this happening kind of isn't good enough, because Google should be aware of this happening.
That's what I mean.
And it picks they bring it up works. And it goes, and I think, bring it up and it goes unnoticed. Yeah. That kind of isn't good enough either.
And I think one of the, I mean, it was sort of a not quite connected point, but one of the points that I read in the article suggested that, you know, when BuzzFeed were talking to Google about this, they were saying, well, you know, do you know how many apps are in the App Store? Like, there's a lot. So, you know,
you're getting money from that. And you've created that. That's my point. You've got to have that dialogue with, if you're putting out that store and saying to people, come and, you know, these are verified by us, then you've got a responsibility to make sure that it is what it says.
And that's exactly how it's happening, right? Yeah. It's happening in that environment, because fraudsters know that there's probably a higher volume, therefore a greater proliferation of potential opportunities within that Google environment, perhaps less checking, perhaps, you know, just not enough.
Yeah, there's
not
enough safety measures, aren't there?
Exactly.
But also, you know, we're talking about the advertisers. What about the users? Because when I was reading that article, it was showing that, as you're saying about, you know, the bots mimicking human behaviour. Mm. So what's happening to that user data? We haven't even thought about that. So, you know, there's also that element of it as well. So, you know, Google, Apple, they have a responsibility to the advertisers and to the users. When you're buying or downloading an app, you should be secure and, you know, safe in the way that you're doing it. And actually, your user data isn't being mimicked and across the web.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, we've got to move on to the third and final news story that we were going to chat about today. So this is actually connected a little bit to a story that came out a couple of weeks back, which is Vodafone reversing their strategy on in-housing media buying. So they've decided not to bring programmatic media buying in-house anymore, and to go back to their closer working relationship with their agency. And the reason I highlighted this is because Brian Weezer from Pivotal, who spoke at ATS London this year, released an investment note to some of his investment community earlier on this week, talking about how he has had a long held opinion that in-housing isn't anywhere near as much of a threat to agency holding groups as everyone likes to make out. And he knows that it makes investors nervous, because they look at the kind of the functions performed by an agency, and then they look at how tech confident and tech savvy and how sort of data immersed a lot of marketers are becoming, and they kind of imagine that it's just a natural shift for marketers to start taking some of that activity that they used to completely outsource to agencies within their own organizations. But he uses this Vodafone story as an example of how it's just not that straightforward. It's not that simple. It's not that easy. And that also, you know, even if there were a whole load of brands out there that are like the idea of bringing their programmatic buying in-house tomorrow, it's not going to happen all at once, and it's not going to happen in a uniform fashion. And it's probably, you know, it's probably also not going to happen in a way that means that it's a straightforward transaction. So, you know, his argument to his investors is, I don't actually think this is a threat. But I just wanted to know what your views were on this, because we spend so much time talking about in-housing versus not in-housing, and, you know, we just have conversations about the pros and cons, and we hear that brands are in-housing more, and then we hear that they're not, and I kind of feel like we're going around in circles. So let's get on the merry-go-round and keep going around in circles and
let's
have another conversation
about jump this. On that. Well, yep. I mean, firstly, you know, in-housing, it's like the term programmatic. Like, what is in-housing and what are you in-housing? It's such an all-encompassing term. Is it your social? Is it your programmatic? Which elements of programmatic? Is it your digital? Is it your audio? You know, it's huge. And for any brand to no matter how big, like at Vodafone, to say, right, we are going to in-house and take business away from our agency, and you know, it's difficult to do, as Vodafone have found out. So firstly, I'd say, you know, is it as big as it's touted to be? Probably not, because how many brands have successfully in-housed all of their media? And how long does it take to do? I was reading an article, I think it was InBev in the US, have taken over 3 years to in-house. It's going to. It's a complete change of the business. Internally, you've got to bring different departments together. You've got to train. You've got to recruit. And you have to work alongside your agency probably during that whole process. You know, the trading element of it. You know, it's just so many different elements to it. So is it a big threat to agencies? I'd say no. Does it happen? Yes. But I think there's an opportunity, agencies, consultancies and everyone, to kind of help brands to do it and to do it successfully.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, fully in-housing is such a huge undertaking. And the interesting thing about Vodafone is, well, first of all, interesting that it's actually gone public, because if you speak to many, many agencies from holding companies, they say there are, I've worked with a number of clients that have in-housed, and then not long after, they've come running back and said, please don't make this public, but we want to come back again because we can't do it. And that is, in itself, is interesting. But the biggest thing about Vodafone actually being public about it and saying, you know, we've in-housed search and social, that's great, and there are many clients that have done that successfully. But then thinking you can go from that to then in-housing programmatic, which is a completely different beast and does not work in the same way, involves God knows how many media owners versus, you know, just two or three when it comes to paid search. It's a huge undertaking, and I'm not sure they ever really quantify how much of an undertaking that's going to be, how much it will cost them, the resource required. And the fact that actually agencies have a lot of resource and a lot of good internal training and a lot of expertise that they can offer the advertiser. But then you look at the other side of in-housing, kind of the hybrid model of in-housing, which is, I will let you guys, my agency, do the execution, but we're going to bring all strategy and planning in-house. And actually, agencies need to fight for that strategy and planning layer and not just become, you know, the execution monkeys. Because, well, the margins aren't there for the agencies for a start. And also, it then doesn't really give them any real insight into what's going on. And it won't allow them to actually show themselves as a true partner to the advertiser if all they're doing is executing what the advertiser has told them to execute.
Yeah.
It's not the same thing. But, I mean, in-housing, I don't think, is as big a threat as people make it out to be. And again, it's that, how are we defining this in the first place?
Yeah, exactly.
And what's the motivations as well? Like, what is the motivation for the brand to in-house? Is it about transparency? Is it about cost? Is it about, you know, understanding more about their business?
Because exactly, closer relationship maybe with their customer.
Exactly,
I mean, in the podcast last week where we had Amir Malik as our guest, he was talking a lot about how, you know, brands need to own and understand their data infrastructure if they actually care about their customers. Mm-hmm. And we talk a bit about that, I suppose, in the context of direct-to-consumer brands. It's that notion that, you know, if you own that relationship, then you've got far better targeting capabilities, you know, you've got so much more sort of granular detail at your fingertips that you have a much better transaction with your customer. So, and I think before, when we've had these discussions, particularly at ATS events, we've often said, is data the differentiator here? Is it about the brand trying to understand their customer data a bit better and trying to be in control of that? So therefore, does in-housing become something to do with data management and execution, and then the rest is handed over to the agency? But I think that connects back to what you were just saying, Ellie, which is, what is the motivation? And also, that's going to be different for each individual brand.
Exactly. And they'll be set up differently internally. I mean, it's you know, even taking the data piece, if you have the different departments, as a lot of the big brands do within marketing, who sit in silo, and, you know, the joined up thinking isn't even within that brand. So before you even think about in-housing, you've got to change your internal way of thinking and communication so that you have an overall view off your brand and how you are going direct to consumer, and then you can look at, right, okay, how does that affect my media, etc. So look inwards before they start looking outwards.
Yeah,
I think to kind of reiterate some comments that were made on stage at ATS London this year, you know, we had Belinda Smith from EA talking on stage about the fact that they have successfully in-housed, but they are fundamentally a game development company. They have the expertise in-house already, kind of in terms of the engineering, the technicians. So for them to actually go and build their own piece of ad tech is not that far removed from their day-to-day jobs anyway. And if any company's going to do it, then that they're the ones that are going to do it. And they are, by all accounts, seeing great success from it. And there are companies out there that can put the resource into that and can make it work for them. Then you had Shula Sinclair from Spark Foundry saying that she had a dairy company.
Yes, I remember that.
A dairy company say they want to build a DMP. Yeah. What on earth is your motivation for that?
Exactly.
That's unbelievable. And actually, people like that should stick to doing what they know.
Exactly.
And, you know, what, again, to your point, Ellie, what is motivation behind it? And I also think we talk about transparency, and I think the word control is often misconstrued as transparency. Mm. So advertisers saying they want transparency, ultimately they want to be able to control everything.
Yeah.
And I think that needs to be kind of unpicked as well.
Yeah.
Because them wanting to have a transparent relationship with the agency is very different from them wanting to own every single part of it and make the agency be their lapdog.
And that's a really good point, actually, Lindsay, because I can understand as a business owner why you want to control many things, because it's really important for you to be in control of a lot of serious shit.
Of
right?
course.
But that doesn't mean...
Yeah, you've got
swear word in. Yay, Joe.
Even without Kieran in the room. This is Exchange Wire after all.
Yeah, there's a lot that goes on.
But yeah, but I mean, you know, you can't, you actually do then have to accept as a business owner at some point that you can't be in control of everything. Some things you have to outsource.
You need
some things you need specialists for. You need to trust somebody else to execute something on your behalf at some stage, somewhere along the line. And you also need to pay them for that. So you need to engage someone that you think is going to be good at delivering that task. And then you need to pay them sufficiently to make sure they do it properly.
Yeah. And cost is a really, you're talking about paying. Cost, I think, is a really big part of it, and a part that brands probably underestimate. You know, if your in-housing or your motivator for in-housing is to kind of reduce or take control of cost, your initial cost is going to be huge in terms of having to hire. And we know there's a skills shortage. So unless you've got a really attractive brand as well, trying to attract, you're fighting, you know, for programmatic or digital specialist, someone going to an agency or going to a sophisticated publisher versus going to a brand, you may think your brand is great, but is it that attractive to hire a lot of great talent into? And even if it is, that's going to cost you a lot of money. You know, having your own technology and resource, that's going to cost you a lot of money, not just the initial outlay, but the upkeep of that. So there are so many different elements to it, and I think brands just really underestimate what in-housing
actually
is.
Actually
and constitutes
going to mean to them.
Right,
run out of time for the news segment, so let's move on to a bit more of a chat with you, Ellie, about what you're up to at the Advisory Collective. Tell us what you're doing.
Cool. So, lots actually, and it's quite an interesting time at the moment. So my background, you know, I've been agency side, been publisher side, which I think is great because it gives me quite insight into the industry. And the reason I started consulting is just because I saw a huge amount of opportunity to speak to brands and agencies and publishers and just help them within digital, again, all-encompassing term digital. So what are we doing? We're helping companies launch into the UK market. And that's really interesting because having launched businesses in the UK market myself, I know how bloody hard it is. See, I can swear now. And companies really underestimate it. So, you know, we all hear about, you know, a company launching and they kind of put one person on the ground and think, okay, we're going to crack the UK market. And then once we start seeing the sales come in, then we put more people. It doesn't work like that. And that strategy will take years. So we will help kind of even pre-launch. Let's look at the strategy. Let's actually look at whether you should launch into this market. And there's been a couple of people that have come to us and we've actually said, you know what? We're not the right people to partner with because actually you are another whatever tech platform it is, and actually you're not going to break through this market because it is so competitive, it's so sophisticated, and it's such a unique market. Even if you have got a successful company in the US or in a company in country in Europe, you have to adapt to the UK market. You know, it's about who you know. That really does help. You have to have that traction, and also you've got to understand the agency landscape, and it's a very complicated landscape, and people are so time poor. I mean, you know, people are under a lot of constraints. So to break through to an agency with just, you know, another new shiny
solution,
it's really, really difficult. So we work with some interesting companies that we actually kind of say, right, actually, we think you've got a great product and we can see you making some noise in this market. Let's build a strategy and let's do a roadmap and take you out there and doing it in the right way. we insist that companies have a marketing budget, because again, companies forget that and they think, okay, yeah, put one person there and then, you know, once the sales come in, we put some money behind. No, actually, you need to let people know who you are and why they should talk to you in the first place. So we put all these kind of criteria down and really work on a bespoke strategy per client to say, this is how we will shape you and grow you in that market. So that's one element of what we do. And then the other is working with UK companies just to help with, whether you call it transformation, acceleration, whatever that may be. What are your pain points, or what are you looking out or reading about and actually thinking that you should be doing? We'll have a conversation with you and see if it's the right strategy for your company, and then help you to execute it. It's coming back to your point, Lindsay, you know, and that client, dairy client who wants to launch a DMP. If it's not right for you, we're not just going to take money and, you know, do it, because it's actually not going to help your business. So just because something's new and shiny doesn't mean it's right for your business. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's mostly, so for the sort of market entry, you're talking about technology vendors.
Yeah, technology vendors. And then we're seeing some interesting, you know, from the US, some interesting stuff out there, which is great, because we get to see what's coming and what's new, and then almost kind of pick and choose and say, okay, this will be really nice to take to market. So that's fun.
Yeah. And on the sort of strategy transformation side, mostly brands?
Yeah. Brands. And it's not kind of competing with agencies. It's kind of working, I suppose, because we can be agile. It's basically going in and saying, sometimes it will be, I know, CMO or CEO that kind of calls you in initially, and then they think that actually this is what they want. And then after you speak to a few different departments, you actually work out, actually, this is what you need.
Not what they
want. Yes. It may be what they want, but this is actually what you need and where we can help you and how we can work alongside your existing business.
Yeah. Nice. And the advisory collective, fairly new. How long?
So I've been consulting for nearly 3 years, and then kind of out there by myself. And it's been great, actually. Via, as I say, it's about your network, and I've worked with some amazing brands across the board on various different projects. And then myself and Lisa Manaldo came together. I mean, I've known her for years anyway via Group M and for our sins a couple of 10 or so years ago when we worked together. But we formed the advisory collective earlier this year, and we're just getting some great traction in the market. So
nice.
Yeah, really pleased.
And I guess having your sort of like you said, your publisher background as well as your agency background just gives you that nice sort of read across from both sides of the industry.
Definitely.
Are you seeing some interesting things that, you know, we need to know about here at Exchange Wire?
in terms of tech, I think there is some good work. A couple of US clients, I think it's interesting what's happening in the video and content, content space. You know, contextual, it's ripe for us. GDPR is just, it is, you know, kind of really given a platform for the contextual space. So that's really interesting, and what's going on in the video space as well. From a publisher perspective, I think the publishers are getting smarter, trying to get smart and working together. So the alliances are really interesting. And it kind of, I look at the alliances, it's like, I used to run an ad network back in the day. Do you know what I mean? And it's a similar thing where actually they're realizing strength in numbers. Let's put aside our differences, because there's some bigger people to fight out there. And actually, you know, you can't do that by yourself. So I think publishers coming together in terms of whether it's be pooling data, some elements or all of our advertising, and Europe as well. I'm speaking to a European client at the moment who are looking at doing something, because they just can't get traction here in the UK. So we're looking at pulling together publishers from around Europe to form an alliance.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So it's kind of, you know, alliance, ad network, whatever you want to call it. It's interesting how things go full circle.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting, because like you're seeing it with TV already with EBX across Europe, and I've always expected the similar sort of thing to happen with kind of more traditional publishers as well.
Yeah, the Ozone project recently,
exactly.
Hasn't it? So, yeah.
But you say the word kind of launching an ad network is like, it's just as long as you don't become an ad network you are launching these alliances.
If you call it an alliance, it's not an ad network.
Yeah, exactly.
We just need to come up with some new terminology.
Exactly. It's actually saying, this is the difference. This is an ad network, this is an alliance.
An alliance.
And it's all in a name. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, I think we've just about run out of time for this week's Mad Tech podcast. So thank you very much, Ellie. It's been delightful to have you.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you, Lindsay.
Pleasure.
Thank you for listening. We'll catch you next week.